Good morning, Fairhaven. My name is Jeremy. I'm one of the pastors here. And this morning, we're going to jump into week four of kind of a mini series in the book of Matthew. If you're new with us, we've started walking through the book of Matthew in the end of last year. We've watched Matthew describe and explain the life of Jesus until now, when we get to this point where Matthew slows down and he focuses on all these interactions, these moments that happen in what will be the last week of Jesus' life before his crucifixion. And what we found in these last few weeks is that in this, the beginning of that last week, Jesus ends up in these confrontations, he's bumping into the powers and the authorities of his world. We see Jesus bump into the power and authority of Rome. We see him bump into the power and the authority of the religious establishment and the temple and those who ran it. We saw Jesus bump into the power, the authority of the religious leaders. And today, we're going to see Jesus do the same. And the response Jesus is going to have is absolutely brilliant. So if you want to follow along with us, we're going to be in Matthew chapter 22 this morning. We will put all the words on the screen. But if you'd like to follow along, we will be in Matthew 22. We'll be starting at verse 15. So Matthew 22, verse 15. It says, "Then the Pharisees went out and laid plans to trap him," Jesus, "in his words. They sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians." Okay, pause. We need to set the scene a little bit because we have two people groups in this story who are attempting to set a trap for Jesus. So these two people groups, we have the Pharisees and we have the Herodians. Okay, who are these people and what is important to these two groups of people? First, let's start with the people that are maybe the most well-known of these two, the Pharisees. If you read through any of the Gospels, kind of the first four books of the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, Jesus, John. Spoiler alert, Jesus is in all of them, right? So Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, they tell the story of Jesus. Gospel means euangelion in the Greek. It means good news. They tell the good news of the story of Jesus. And one of the things we find is that Jesus is often in these kind of confrontations, in these arguments with a group of the Pharisees. Now, who are the Pharisees? Well, the Pharisees are kind of these religious elite. The Pharisees are these devout Jewish religious leaders. The Pharisees, to kind of commonize, like, the Pharisees are kind of they're the pastors. They're the seminary professors. They are the religious leaders. The Pharisees, one of the things that's really important to the Pharisees is that all of the Jewish people obey Torah, that they follow the law. The obedience to law is absolutely fundamental to the life and the view of the Pharisees. They believe that if all of the Jewish people would just follow all of the law perfectly, then God would send his Messiah into the world, right? The Pharisees are these devout religious elites. Okay, what about that other group? The Herodians. Do you notice even in the word Herodian, you hear the name, the title of somebody we've talked about often in the Gospels, right? You hear the name Herod. Herod, who is Herod? Well, Herod was the guy in charge. He was put in place by Rome to oversee the nation of Israel. When Jesus is born, it was a guy by the name of Herod the Great. Herod the Great will die. Herod's kingdom will essentially kind of get split into three in Israel and go to his kids. The Herodians were especially fond of this one son of Herod the Great, a guy by the name of Herod Antipas. The Herodians is this group of people who have essentially, they've kind of cozied up to Rome. I mean, they're in power. They're the big guys. Like, why get in the way of Rome? And what the Herodians want is they want to see this Herod Antipas in charge. The Pharisees, the devout religious elite, the religious leaders, they look at their position under Rome. Rome, the superpower of the world that is overseeing, that is oppressing the nation of Israel. And what the Pharisees want is the Pharisees want to do away with Rome. They dream of a Jewish world where they are now free, they're independent, they can kind of restore this kingdom of David within Israel where they are independent, they are free from Rome. The Herodians are the people who are working with and kind of alongside of Rome. They're cozying up with Rome. They want this Herod Antipas kind of in charge. The Pharisees, the Herodians, these two groups disagree on a ton. There is a ton they disagree with. And yet, in this story, they come together to set a trap against Jesus. Why? Let's play a little game. How many of you root for these guys? If you root for these guys, can I get a go blue? Yes. Okay. How many of you root for these guys? If you're one of them, can you say go green? Okay. How many of you just want them to lose? Can I hear a beat Ohio? Tear, right? Like, it's beautiful. Right, now let's get that off the screen. We're going to give the computer a virus. Okay. So, blue, green, you throw the Ohio State, all of a sudden, like, our differences don't matter as much because we have the common enemy in them, right? Pharisees and the Herodians, they disagree on a ton. What they agree on is Jesus is the problem. What they agree on is that Jesus is a threat to their power or their staying in power. For the Pharisees, Jesus is threatening this thing that they've created in this religious establishment, this thing that is in its own way oppressing the people. To the Herodians, Jesus is speaking against Herod. He's speaking against Caesar. He's saying that man is not God. This man poses a threat to both camps. And so the Pharisees and the Herodians decide to come together, to work together to try to pin that guy. Let's check out the trap. A teacher, they said, we know that you are a man of integrity and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by others because you pay no attention to who they are. You can feel them buttering him up, right? Tell us then, what is your opinion? Is it right to pay the imperial tax to Caesar or not? This is their question. This is their trap. Is it right to pay the imperial tax to Caesar or not? Okay, so what is the imperial tax? How is this a trap? Well, first, if you were somebody who was living in the first century in Israel, taxes are something you saw a ton of. They actually estimate that in the first century Israel, somewhere around 49% of your income would go out in taxes. 32 of it would go to Rome. 19 of it would go would be taxes from the Jewish people. And then 5% you would kind of lose to corrupt officials. And so there is this large debate happening about, do you pay the tax to Rome? Rome, after all, they are this giant empire. They are those other guys. They're not your people. They've come in and now they have conquered and they are oppressing you. Do you fund the machine that is oppressing you? And the Pharisees and the Herodians, you can already probably tell that they disagree on this tax. The Pharisees want nothing to do with Rome. They want a Jewish state, a Jewish nation, Jewish people that is free from Rome. The Herodians, do they think you pay the tax? Absolutely, they think you should pay the tax. And so they're trying to put Jesus in this spot where if Jesus says, yes, pay the tax, the Pharisees then get to go, look at you. You're just like those Herodians. You're okay with Rome. You're okay funding this Roman machine that is oppressing the people. Jesus loses his following. To the Herodians, if Jesus says, don't pay the tax, what are the Herodians going to do? They're going to run to Herod. They're going to run, or maybe the governor, and they're going to say, hey, this guy is telling the people not to pay the taxes to Rome. And what happens to Jesus? He's arrested as an insurrectionist who's trying to tell the people not to pay taxes to Rome. They think they've put Jesus in this impossible binary trap of a place where Jesus is going to implicate himself. They can't see a way Jesus gets out. But what they've done is completely underestimated the brilliance of Jesus in this moment, because Jesus is going to almost pull this, like, Jesus jujitsu move on both camps, which is fascinating. Let's check out Jesus' response. But Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said, "You hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? Show me the coin used for paying the tax." Okay, real quick pause. Jesus asked them to show him the coin that's used for paying the tax. Easy question. What does that imply? Does Jesus have the coin? No. Right? Jesus says, show me the coin that's used for paying the tax, which means Jesus doesn't have what? The coin needed for paying the tax. Hold on to that. Let's keep going. They brought him a denarius, and he, Jesus, asked them, "Whose image is this, and whose inscription?" "Well, Caesar's," they replied. So the coin that they use, it's this denarius. Let me show you a picture. So on the left is the current Caesar during this time in Jesus' life. It is a guy by the name of Tiberius. So this is the denarius, this coin that contains the image of the emperor Tiberius. Now, why is this important? Because remember, did Jesus have the coin? No. Did the Pharisees and the Herodians have the coin? Yes. They show it to Jesus. Why is that important? Well, let's back up in the story and ask, where are we? Where is this story happening geographically? Because Matthew doesn't tell us in chapter 22 where we are. But if we back up just a little bit into Matthew 21, we get Matthew telling us about where Jesus is going. And then in Matthew 24, we see Jesus move again. Let me show you. So just before the story, Matthew 21, the story we looked at last week, says Jesus entered the temple courts, and while he was teaching, the chief priests, the elders, the people came to him. "By what authority are you doing these things?" they asked. The story we looked at last week. So in Matthew 21, Jesus arrives where? The temple courts. We have the end of Matthew 21, Matthew 22, Matthew 23. If we go to Matthew 24, we see the next movement of Jesus. It says Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came to him to call his attention to its buildings. Matthew 21, Jesus arrives at the temple courts. Matthew 24, Jesus leaves the temple, which then implies that Matthew's telling us, where is Jesus in Matthew 22 and 23? The temple courts. We looked at the temple 2 weeks ago. This is a picture of the temple. If you remember 2 weeks ago, if you were here, we talked about how the temple had a number of different courts. The largest of which, that big area that's inside that temple wall, we talked about that was the court of the Gentiles. We looked at how when Jesus entered Jerusalem during this week, he found his way into the temple courts, and what he found in that court of the Gentiles, the place where the world was supposed to gather to worship God, what Jesus found were a bunch of tables that he ends up flipping over. Do you remember whose tables they were? So, one, there were people that were selling animals that would be used in the sacrifices, right? The religious establishment that we talked about how in many ways was oppressing the very people it was supposed to be serving. But the people selling weren't the only tables. Do you remember the other table? The money changers. Why was there a table for money changers? Remember we talked about how there were money changers' tables because you were not supposed to bring the Roman coinage onto the temple mount. So you would bring those coins to the money changers. You would change them out for a temple coin. Why did we say the difference? Because the coins you bring on the temple were not supposed to bear the image of somebody. Why? because the Jewish people remembered a command that God gave them in what we know as the Ten Commandments, where God says this. It says, you shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above or the earth beneath or in the waters below. So question, is that an image? Yes. This is an image of the Caesar. This is a thing you do not bring on the Temple Mount. So do you see what Jesus is already doing? Does Jesus have the coin in our story? No. Of course he's not carrying the coin. He's on the Temple Mount. You don't bring a carved image on the Temple Mount. But in the story, when the Pharisees and the Herodians try to trap Jesus, what Jesus first does is expose the hypocrisy of the very people who are trying to trap him. Because who are the ones who are carrying the carved image on the Temple Mount? The Pharisees and the Herodians. You can almost feel Jesus in the story, like the moment they pull out the coin in the place they're not even supposed to have it. You can almost feel like Jesus like gives a little wink, like, huh, interesting. Look what you guys have. So already Jesus, the very beginning of what they're trying to do to trap him, exposes their hypocrisy. It's interesting, the corners that they were willing to cut. It's willing, the lengths they were willing to go to in order to get or maintain their power. So Jesus essentially already exposes the hypocrisy of the Pharisees and of the Herodians. But then he recognizes, remember what he asks. It's not just what image is this. He asks something else. If we look at it, they brought him a denarius. He asks, whose image is this and whose inscription? Caesar's, they replied. Because if we go back to the coin, it's not only an inscription, it's not only an image of the Caesar, but you can see there's words around it. Now, around that inscription, it's going to say, Augustus Tiberius, the son of the divine Augustus. Divine Augustus, which means the coin says Augustus is what? A god? And then Tiberius, the son of a god? And so Jesus points out again that you, on the Temple Mount, have brought a carved image that is not just an image. It's an image that is declaring the person that's carved onto it as being a very God. Jesus exposes their hypocrisy, but Jesus isn't done. Let's continue. Then he said to them, so give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. When they heard this, they were amazed, so they left him and went away. Now, question, why were they amazed? Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, give to God what's God's, and the crowd is just floored. They're amazed. They've got no more questions. They can't press anymore. They realize their trap is done, and they leave. Why? What did Jesus do in that? Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, give to God what is God's. Well, one of the things Jesus did is he flipped the conversation. The thing that started as a conversation around a tax, Jesus flips the conversation when he says, okay, whose image is on that coin? Whose image is that? And Jesus moves the conversation from a conversation about whether or not you pay a tax to a conversation about an image that is on that piece of metal, on that coin, because Jesus' audience would have been familiar with this idea of image, this concept of image. We read about image all over our Bibles. Paul will actually, one of the ways he'll describe Jesus is Paul will say that Jesus is the image of the invisible God, that to see Jesus is to see God. But Paul is using this image language that we first experience way earlier. All the way back in the first chapter of the Bible, in Genesis chapter 1, we read this about image. It says, God says, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. You can hear the repetition in there, can't you? He created them in his image. In his image, he created them. Jesus, by calling the conversation around image, says, okay, whose image is on the coin? Well, Caesar's. But Jesus also wants to remember whose image is stamped on you? It's not Caesar's. It's the very image of God. And so Jesus, almost at the very beginning of his answer, almost saying, even if you're going to give that thing to Caesar, even if you're going to give that coin, never give Caesar your heart. Never give Caesar your worship. Never give Caesar your allegiance. Never give Caesar your hope. Never give Caesar your heart, because you bear the inscription of somebody else. You bear the image of someone else. You were created in the image of God, not Caesar. So even if you're going to give that thing is simply a piece of metal with a face on it. You were created in the image of God. But then I think if we play with Jesus' answer, it goes even further. Because if we're talking about the idea of image, of how big God's reign, God's rule is anything outside of it? What doesn't find itself under the rule and the reign of God? Psalm 24 is going to open with these words. It says, the entire earth is the Lord's, and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. So if we go back to Jesus' answer, give to Caesar what's Caesar's, but give back to God what's God's, the question, if you give back to God what's God's, is there anything left to give to Caesar? No. The entire earth is the Lord's and everything in it. So if you give to God what is God's, there is simply nothing left to give to Caesar. So Jesus essentially answers the question. And in a lot of ways, he's saying, no, everything is God's. But Jesus answers the question in a way that the Pharisees and the Herodians, they don't have any ground to stand on anymore, right? Because in the wake of Jesus' answer, it's not like they can come back and go, technically Caesar has control of... They are going to get ruined. Everybody leaves them because they then expose themselves. Jesus does this brilliant jujitsu move in starting a conversation that they're trying to trap him about, a conversation of tax. He moves it to a conversation of image. And essentially it goes to a conversation around ownership. Who you are owned by the thing that's image you bear. Give to Caesar what's Caesar's, give to God what's God's. And Jesus wants us to wrestle with the question of, what are the things that own us? What are the things that own us? As somebody who bears the image of God in Jesus' world, Caesar, Rome, power was all trying to jockey for positions of power. We're all trying to draw people's hearts towards power. And Jesus saying, no, the entire earth is the Lord's and everything in it. Give everything to God. So the question I want us to grapple with is, what are the things that threaten to own us today? Because we are here, and you were created in the image of God. You were created in the image of God. Whose are you? You are a child of God, because that's simply who you are. But I think we still live in a world where a number of things still try to jockey for our heart. They still try to draw for our attention. They still try to demand our worship. So what are the things that do that for you? What are the things in your life, in our world, that try to own us? I'll start with just the example, because the story was about a denarius. So if I bring, we don't really value coins anymore. So if I just, this thing, right? The question around money that I think the story calls us to ask is, do I own this? Or does this own me? Because this is just a piece of paper, right? This is simply a piece of paper. Whether I own this or this owns me, can we agree? It depends on what my attitude, what my heart, how my heart is in relation to this, right? Because this thing could quickly own me if I'm willing to make sacrifices for it. I'm willing to put my hope and my trust. I'm willing to put my faith in this. This thing could quickly own me. Or I could recognize that I am owned by somebody else, that I bear the image of a God who created all things. I could recognize, just in a change of heart, that I can own this. And when I own this, it frees me to live with it differently. It frees me to live a life of generosity because I realize this thing doesn't have my heart. Does that make sense? What is it that owns you? What is it that's calling for your heart? Maybe it's a job. It's one of the things that we can, one of the ways that we can ask the question is, what are the things that we give the most, our most of our time and our energy and our attention towards? For some of us, we might say job, and I'd say the job is similar. Like, if the job is a thing that we go to in order to get this return, like, we might get owned by it. But if we simply have a different perspective and we view job as not just an occupation, but maybe a vocation, a thing that God is, a place where God has currently placed us with people that we currently have the opportunity to engage in, we can start viewing our work differently. As not something that we're owned by, but as something that we maybe get the opportunity to do as witnesses, as representatives of God in all of the places that He's placed us, in whatever place He's placed us. What are the things that own us? Maybe for some of us, it's our past success or our past failure. Maybe it's the words that we repeat in our heads that maybe somebody has spoken over us or about us at some point, or the words that we continue to tell ourselves are true. What are the things in your life, in your circumstances, in your world that are threatening, that are begging for your heart? And may we, as we identify those, as we name those things in our lives, may we follow the way of Jesus. May we bring those things to Jesus. May we essentially place them at the cross of Jesus, at the foot of the cross, as we recognize what is true, as we recognize who we are, that we are people who are owned, yes. We are people who bear an image, yes. But we bear the image of the God who created us, who formed us, who shaped us, who loves us more than we could ever imagine. Which is going to bring us to communion. But before we do, would you pray with me? God, as people, your people formed in your image, God, we pray that we would shake off anything and everything that is trying to draw our hearts away from you. Any of the things that vie for our worship, that vie for our hearts, God, may we bring them to the foot of the cross. May we believe what you have said is true, that we are people created in your image who are loved. May we live in that love. We pray this all in Jesus' name. Amen.